Live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3510 of the Survival Podcast. I want to start out with, I got a ton of great feedback about my show I did yesterday with Nick Ferguson. It went over 2 hours. And, you know, this isn't the Joe Rogan show. We do fairly long-form podcasts, generally in the neighborhood of about 90 minutes. And I do that because I know people have really, really valuable time. Like, your time is just as valuable as my time, folks. And so when you spend over 2 hours with somebody on a podcast, that says something, and it's humbling. And so thank you for all the kind words, and thank you to everybody that showed up and hung out with us yesterday. And I talked to Nick, and I don't want to make them all 2 hours and 20 minutes or whatever, but we may be doing like the Spearco Ferguson monthly thing into the future. There's plenty of stuff for Nick and I to talk about. He's a good friend. We've been friends for about 11 years now. And just like I do once a month, I do the First Tuesday podcast with John and Nicole. Maybe we'll do like a once a month thing with Nick. I think that might be cool. Of course, you can ask Nick Ferguson questions whenever you want to. He is a member of our expert council, and I need questions for the expert council. You want to email me for anything, but especially the expert council, then what you want to do is you want to send an email to me. And it amazes me that anybody doesn't know my email that watches this show or listens to this show at this point. But it is jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. And by putting TSPC in the subject line, you'll ensure that it gets through my spam filtering and that I actually see it. So what are we going to talk about today? We're going to talk about the future from a different angle. I've done plenty of content on this show that relates to kids and young adults. And despite what some people infer, most of it has not been in any way bashing young people. And today certainly isn't either. This is about looking ahead into the future and not that far. Many people would say 10 years, that's a long time. If you've been around a while, you know that 10 years is like that. So mid-2030s, what's the landscape going to look like for Gen Zs and Gen Alphas? And here's where I'm coming from today. I'm a grandfather, as many of you guys know. And people say, you know, when you have kids, you start to think more about the future. And I know you do, because I was also, obviously, to become a grandfather, you have to be a father first. And when I became a father, I started thinking about the future. But I think when you become a grandfather, you really think about the future. Because as a grandfather, you're less confident that you'll be here while your grandchildren are, you know, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30 years of age. Kind of that point in young adulthood where you're finding yourself. Where I think most of us, unless, you know, we have some kind of terminal disease or something, or lives on some kind of crazy ass lifestyle or whatever, you feel pretty certain when you're a 30-year-old father that you'll be around for your 30-year-old, you know, your son when he's 30. And being young like I was when I became a father, yeah, you really feel like, hey, I'll be here for him until, you know, if your kid can't get on their feet by the time they're in their 30s, there's really not much you can do. Right. At that point, like a 30-year-old man or woman has got to like step up and make things happen. But there is that kind of transitional period leading up to your 30s. See, I feel like your 30s, early 30s, mid 30s is when you should be punching the throttle with your career. You should be hitting your stride. Right. You should know what you want to be because you're grown up, not when you grow up. Right. But that 18 to 24, 25, where frankly, and probably this is where I think about it more, I had no one. I moved down here to Texas when I got out of the Army. I was barely 21 years old. I had a roommate and friend. And my friends, like the TV show, became what I had as a family. But they only do so much for you because they're not really family. And so when you're a grandfather, you can see that, you know, maybe when these kids are in their mid-30s, I won't be here. Or if I am, I'll need them more than they need me. And that, so then you also feel like, well, maybe I won't really be there to help them through this crap. And I think that makes you think even more about it. Then you start looking at the landscape and saying, well, what's it going to look like? So what today I want to do is I want to talk to you about what I think it will look like 10 years from now, the year 2034, which if you're tuning in today and you're like 19, 10 years, like, dude, I ain't worried about 10 years. And I got to tell you, when I was 19, I was not really thinking 10 years out myself. I was sort of kind of, but I wasn't really worried. Like, that's some, like, you're not worried about next month unless you know something's coming, let alone next decade when you're in that age bracket. But as we age, we, you know, the phrase I use all the time, the days are long, but the years are short. And you realize, like, 2034 is just around the corner. And these kids that I have, right now I have one that's 13, he'll be 23, my grandson. And my granddaughter in 10 years will be 18. You know, those are the ages where you're trying to find yourself for real. You're trying to either get into school or some sort of trade, or you're already working. And when I look 10 years out, I don't see a lot of happiness. I see a bridge through the 2030s into the 2040s that if you get to the other side of it in good shape, I actually think society has a real track record, unless we start tossing the luff balloons around or something and mushroom clouding each other. Society has this pattern of completely destroying and then rebuilding itself, and that rebuilding itself being in a glorious state. But if you have kids in the age range I'm talking about, or if you have grandchildren in the age range I'm talking about, so they're in their late 20s, mid-30s, now in your late 30s, mid-40s on the other side of this catastrophe, and if you didn't get through it well, you can have a lot of problems in your life that are hard to make go away at that point. So as a grandfather, knowing that I have a lot of parents and grandparents in this audience and people that are intelligent thinking individuals, I thought this would be a good subject today. And this came from last night. Darcy and I were having a discussion about how, and it's true, she's right. Sometimes I'm too hard on Braylon over things like doing his jobs and stuff. But the jobs I have that kid do, they're not rough. And I even had a conversation with him yesterday. I said, don't you think at this point, as well as we pay you, and all the crap I have to go through to get you to do the little bit about the chores that we kind of give you to have something to do here, that my life would actually be easier if I just did it, so I ain't doing it for me. And he said, yeah, you're probably right. I said, at least kids think, right? I said, so why do you think I do it? He goes, well, I guess for me. And the problem is, boy's got no work ethic. And I'm not putting him down. He's my grandson. I love him. He just doesn't have a work ethic. In fact, his work ethic is he is willing to put 2 units of energy into avoiding 1 unit of energy of work. And that's a bad thing. What I tried to get across to him is when I came up in the world through this time that we're talking about, coming through like your late teens into your late 20s, early 30s, I did really well eventually. But I started with less than zero. Like, I had nothing going for me. But one thing, I would work. And I would work harder than everybody around me. I would work harder than my boss. I would work harder than his boss. If somebody had to stay late, it was me. Sometimes I would stay late when I wasn't asked to. And even if I didn't get paid, I didn't care. If something wasn't done, I'll get it done. And a lot of times it was 10 minutes. You know, but I was still the last one out the door. And that goes so far for you. And it scares me that we're not preparing children for a world where that's one of the many things we'll talk about today that they're going to need to thrive while others get flat out destroyed, because that's going to happen to some people. And I don't want it to be my kids or your kids. So we're going to talk about the problem itself and how to avoid that today. Before we do there, I've got a really interesting thing that popped up today for me. John Bush got his banner updated on my website finally. He's got this webinar coming up, and I'm glad I looked into it today because it happens tomorrow. It's completely free, and it may help with this very thing of how do we get through this tumultuous time that we're about to go through. It's called the Freedom Trinity Webinar, and it's talking about setting up the legal framework to exist as much as you can outside of the world of regulated systems through things like private membership associations and other structures, how to win that game of 5D chess that we're playing, whether we know it or not. And again, John's put this together. He always does a great job. Sign up for the seminar, which is virtual, and it's tomorrow. You can do that for free. And I know you're going to ask me, you know, can I watch it over and over again? Usually this is how it works. John usually has like a grace period, a certain number of days. And I don't know that right now because he just got his banner updated where you can watch the replay, and then there's a paid option where you get more, plus you get the replay like forever. But just go check it out. In fact, I would say right now, even in the middle of this live stream, if you're watching this live, right down there in the video notes, there's a link for this and a bunch of other great links as well. I'd go click that, fill out that form. Just do it right away, and that way you can make sure that you'll be able to attend that. Because, again, I think a lot of the stuff that John's talking about right now is the type of thing that we need to be looking at to set up structures to get through a time when they're going to want to regulate literally everything. Next up today, John Pugliano with the Wealth Studying Podcast. John and I have been friends and worked together since 2010 when I first met him in Salt Lake City at a prepper convention. He is an awesome investment manager. He has been a great service to this community for a long time as an expert council member as well. He's helped countless members of this community. He's got a great podcast called the Wealth Studying Podcast, where you can learn to grow your wealth like you grow a garden. And what I love about his podcast is it's usually about once a week, sometimes once every 2 weeks, and it's like 8 to 15-minute episodes. So it doesn't take a lot of time to gain a lot of wisdom with John. So check him out today at wealthstudying.com. And Investable Wealth is his other site. You should probably check that one out too. With that, let's dig off into this. And again, I'm coming at this not really at all from a place of fear, even though I have the word fear or scares anyway in the title. It's not like I sit in bed at night chewing on my fingernails and worrying what's going to happen to my grandson in 10 years. When I say fear, I mean I simply look at the landscape and I look at what we're headed to. I look at what history says about when a society behaves this way. I think back to when I was 21 years old and I first came to Texas. I had my military service, which frankly no one cared about. This is what I found out about military service. Once I had relevant experience in an industry and I was applying for a job in that industry, the fact that I served in the Army meant a lot. It was, I guess it's a lot like college, right? Until I had the relevant experience, the fact that I was in the military was like, oh, so you show up on time. That was what it bought me. Like, you could get any, like, entry-level shit job you wanted because they knew, well, this guy knows how to show up on time and show up dressed and not start fights at work, right? If you made it through, got honorable discharge, good to go. But other than that, like, you're, like, even as a, like, looking for jobs as a mechanic, which I really didn't want to do, but I was willing to do anything to earn a paycheck when I got down here to Texas, like, they didn't care. Oh, you know how to work on military trucks. Doesn't mean you know how to work on an Audi, which is sort of kind of true. And I just think about how hard it was. And then I look back and say, well, what was the mid-90s, early 90s like from a standpoint of opportunity? And the reality is it was pretty damn fantastic. It was pretty fantastic because a guy like me with no relevant experience was able to break into the telecommunications market. First as a contractor, I got that job just because I was willing to travel and other people weren't, and I was willing to pay for tools and buy my own tools and other people weren't. That gave me enough experience, and the data cable, data network market exploded here locally in Dallas-Fort Worth. That got me off the road. That got me more experience. I specialized in fiber optics. I ended up kind of as a contractor married to one customer being Lockheed Martin. That took off for me, and then I made a leap into sales, and my whole life took off. And as hard as it seemed, when I took my first full-time job down here, which was packing boxes for $5.90 an hour, the path was there. I just needed to walk it. And all I needed to be able to walk it was a willingness to sacrifice and a willingness to work hard and the willingness to do what others would not. And when I look at the 2030s, I think that's going to be necessary, but it's going to be a much less, or a much more narrow path. There's only so much room for so many people on that path. And what I have to say is back then the path was really wide, and because there was so much opportunity, very few people were willing to take it. But if we move into a different time, which we're going to, because that's how time works, it is linear and temporal, at least from our mortal existence, from our vantage point, it's going to be rough. It's going to be a much more narrow path. And there's one, you don't have all this other peripheral bullshit opportunity when things start to collapse. And I don't mean end of the world collapse. I mean, let's look at it this way. Do you know one of the things I shared yesterday on social media was an article about how the third, that's one, two, three, blah, ha, ha. Anybody remember that? Back when TV was actually educational, right? When PBS was actually useful. Three colleges have closed this year in the state of Pennsylvania, not in the country. Three colleges so far, I just reported on the third one, shut their doors, said, we're done, we're out of business. Right here in Texas, the Plano School District, and this is rich people central. Plano, Texas is a very, very affluent area of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, closing three elementary schools and three junior highs after this year. Six schools. Okay, when you have universities and public schools not just laying off employees, literally closing, this is a bad canary in the coal mine moment. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people out there when I make predictions and they start to come true, go, Jack must be really proud of himself. No, a lot of this shit I want to be wrong about. I want to be wrong. I want to have to come back on the air 2024, like right now, and say, yeah, I know I said that school districts and colleges and all, I even wrote an article about it in early 2020. I said this was all going to happen. And here we are 4 years later, and it just didn't happen, and so I must have been wrong. Instead, it's all happening the way that I said it would. And that makes me more confident in my future predictions, and it makes my stomach sink a little bit. So I really feel like we're in a position now where a lot of the things that I think are going to happen, and I don't claim to know. I don't claim to know because I can't know. Anybody that tells you they can know the future 100% accurately and is not driving around in a gold-plated Rolls Royce is a fucking liar. Because if I absolutely knew the future 100% of anything, I'd be making bank in Vegas if nothing else, let alone what you could do with investments. So all I can do is extrapolate what it probably looks like. But when we're at a place where we owe over $34 trillion, where I don't even think there's $34 trillion in the world, okay? And I don't mean just U.S. dollars. I mean, really, there's so much phantom money supply out there. I mean, real hard value behind the money. I don't think $34 trillion exists, and we're just one country in kind of debt like that, and all the countries are in debt to each other. Like a bunch of dominoes all leaning up against each other, where instead of like a domino chain, like when one falls, they all just poof straight to the ground. So I don't know how we get out of that. When we are spending more on interest on that debt than a Department of Defense, I don't know how we get out of it. When we already know, and we do know this by math, unless they figure out a way to outspend their interest, which only results in the interest climbing eventually, we will spend more money on interest on the debt than we do on Social Security by 2030. For those that haven't learned math at all or are still trying to figure out new math, that's only 6 years. That's not, you know, if you have a six-year-old kid, think back to the day they were born and how recent that seems. That's how close we are to where we spend more money on the interest on the debt than we do on Social Security, which is going bankrupt, by the way. If we can't pay Social Security and the debt interest, you see where this all just starts to collide with each other. Then we have gone out of our way to alienate every country we can against us. Even our allies don't particularly like us at this point. But we have a coalition forming, and I know I've talked about this since 2008, but the BRICS coalition, well, something's happening there. You know, Buffalo Springfield, there's something happening here, right? What it is ain't exactly clear. Well, this is clear. We have thrown Putin and Xi into each other's arms. So they had an economic agreement in the foundation of the BRICS, you know, 16 years ago with Brazil and India as part of it. And again, I always say this, but people just overlook how big a deal this is. India and China together have more than half the people in the world. That's kind of a big deal. Well, now we have Putin running off and hugging on Kim Jong-un in North Korea. And then, yeah, before I go back to Russia, let me cruise on over to Vietnam and hang out with those guys. You know what that's about? That's about bringing North Korea and Vietnam into the BRICS fold. The next war, I said this either this week or last week already on the air, the next war will not be fought with bombs unless something goes sideways, and it always could. But I think the next real world war, World War III, you know, the result saying, I don't know what weapons World War III or World War, I don't know what weapons World War III will be fought with, but World War IV will be fought with a board with a nail in it or something like that. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think what we're going to have is an economic war. And when you get more than half of the global population together on one side of it, you got a problem. And we also have, you know, the U.S. dollar is going to lose, not might, it is going to, sooner or later, lose its status as the world reserve currency. And we have so much fictitious bullshit as a nation with both hard and soft power projection that is tied to that reality. And Saudi Arabia just said, yeah, the petrodollar, yeah, we don't need that no more. So Saudi Arabia no longer has an agreement with us to price oil, right, in dollars and only take dollars for oil. They can now do anything they want. People don't understand. That was an agreement. That was a binding treaty that we had with the Saudis. And if Saudi went, all of OPEC went. So all of a sudden, you lose this ability to control the world with soft power projection through economics by having the currency that the world trades in and being the only source of it. Talk about some chickens coming home to roost. How about some vultures coming home to roost? I don't see any way out of a massive transitional shift. Then add in technology, artificial intelligence, all that. I know some of you guys ain't believers in that, but you can already see its impact. It's just that the world is such a big place. The United States is such a big place. And there's so many systems of redundancy that really bad shit can happen. And it kind of shifts over here and it still looks okay. We're now the ship caught in the black hole that sees another ship deeper in the black hole and thinks we're trying to help it. But that's just our reflection. We're looking up at the top of the pond and we're the one down in the hole. We just ain't started being strung out yet into a thin thread. That's really where we're at in this from an economic standpoint. And I just feel this all has to happen. But one of the things I've noticed is I just looked at some data yesterday. You know, you would think if you had a skill set of being a coder, someone that can write code, you got pretty good lock on always having something you can be doing. And if you're entrepreneurial, you do. But just the impact of like ChatGPT being able to write Python and stuff like that, the number of coders with jobs in the United States has plummeted over the last 4 years. A lot of stuff that coders were used for that were simple projects, but they were simple from a standpoint of what you wanted something to do wasn't that big a deal, but it required a knowledge of a language that they didn't speak. So imagine there's no translation software, you don't speak any Spanish, and you need something you've written changed into Spanish. This is not hard to do unless you don't speak Spanish. So you would pay somebody pretty good money to make that translation for you if we didn't have Google Translate in 1985. There was pretty good business in being able to translate languages in 1985. There's no money in that at all anymore. Unless you're talking about some, you know, historian or something translating some Rosetta Stone level crap, there's no money in doing language translation anymore. Folks, computer coding is just language translation. How do I tell the computer what I want the computer to do where the computer will understand it and be able to do it? Well, we now have, you know, marketing teams, management teams, etc., that are doing 90% of their own code work, letting AI write it for them. And that's where that plummet is. But, oh, all the jobs went overseas. No, all the jobs like that went overseas in the fucking 90s. They made a movie about it. It was called Office Space. That's when that happened. There was so much growth that it got compensated for. But now Bill that runs the project, you know, is project manager for a team's like, well, we need this. And Tom's like, I got it. And maybe they need a coder. But they need one coder once in a while where they used to have a team on standby to do all their shit for them. This is where this is coming from, guys. This is, and Rachel's saying it right now. We got a lot of people in the live stream. Please hit like for us. It helps a lot. I really appreciate it if you do. So what are we gonna have to get in the minds and hearts and skill sets of our young people for them to be able to navigate this bridge through the 2030s into the 2040s so that they can be in good standing in their own lives as the new opportunities really start to come in? Because I believe they will. I believe we'll get through this. There's just a lot of people that can get run over and just damaged beyond reasonable repair in the interim. You know, the problem when we discuss history is this is the way you learn about the Great Depression. Well, a lot of people invested in the stock market, made a lot of money, and too much money went in, and eventually the stock market crashed. At the same time, we had an agricultural recession because of the Dust Bowl, which just was bad luck. And then World War II happened, and it was over. Well, the reality is the stock market high in 1929 was not regained until 1963. And a little bit of shit went on in between what you learned in school, isn't there? Did anybody learn that, like, at the high school level, that stock market crash in 29 didn't actually come back to its former level until 1963? There probably ain't a lot of people alive today that can tell you anything about 1929 because they were there and they saw it. Because even if there's some people around that were alive, they were really little and they don't remember shit. Right? And you're talking about somebody that's, what, six years shy of 100 if they were born in 29. But if you want to ask people about 1963, there's plenty of people around to tell you all about what they were doing in 1963, their first jobs, worrying about getting drafted into the military, all kinds of stuff. So 1963 and 1929 have a pretty damn big gap in them. So what happened to people in that interim? There was a lot of people that were damaged beyond all repair. There were a lot of people that came out of it still here, but they really didn't have shit. But at least they ended up with what? Coming out of the great socialism move forward in the 30s with FDR, Social Security. And if you had a Social Security check in 1963, you could afford to live on it. We all know you can't do that now. My wife has drawn her Social Security. She gets $1,300 a month. $1,300 a month doesn't do shit, right? It's a nice little supplement. It might cover your basic housing costs, but everything else you still got to come up with. So we are way worse off now than most people were in 1963. I'm just going to tell you, I think that we'll be more worse off in the delta between, let's say, go back to 2014 and 2034, that 20-year gap will be a bigger degradation than what we've had from the 60s till now in quality of life and what it takes to be successful. So what do I think people are going to need to succeed that are going to be hitting their prime working years through this transitional space? One is they are either going to have to be extremely highly skilled specialists, or they are going to have to be very flexible with high work ethic generalists. And so what I mean by that is if there will always be the place for the top engineering student to have a really good job somewhere in the country. I don't care how screwed up everything is, your top talent out of MIT and shit like that, they're going to have jobs. They're going to have jobs. And don't let anybody tell you any different. Let me tell you, I remember, I have like a freaky memory, and I can tell you that in second grade in Catholic school, before I got myself kicked out of Catholic school the first time, they should have never sent me back. Once I got kicked out once, I knew how to get kicked out again, right? And I didn't want to be there. But I remember a teacher telling me about how all the kids that were graduating high school in the 70s were told that engineering was the future. And I was a little kid. I thought engineers drove trains. I didn't really know what they were talking. But I remember this. And she said there's going to be this glut of engineers in the 80s. And all of those people, their degrees won't be what they thought they worth what they thought they were. Well, engineers have done pretty well from the 80s up till now. Your top engineers will be okay. whether it's engineering, whether it's being a doctor, anything that requires a high level of education, a high level of intelligence, and a hell of a work ethic to be in the top 10, 20% of, those people are going to be okay. You know, assuming somebody doesn't shoot them when they're walking to their car or something. I can't speak for that. What I mean by flexible generalists, think of this as like the polymath handyman type mindset. The person that can just shift from one thing to the next and do anything and marries it with the fluidity and the ability to be fluid cognitively as well and adapt to change, that person will probably be okay. What I'm saying is I think that there is a future for the best of the best, the dedicated, in both blue-collar and white-collar places. But there's going to be a lot less room for those people to do well. Right now, the issue is, for every really great engineer, he's probably carrying four or five on his back that are just, you know, the term is quietly quitting. They're doing just enough work not to get fired. Well, companies are starting to figure out, hey, you know, we can fire a shitload of people and nothing really changes. We had so much fiat growth between 71 and now that we got to a point where people just started growing their company for the sake of growing it. They started treating public companies, or public and private companies, but private industry, like government bureaucracy. See, and this has been more and more the case. When I originally read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, he described it, Kiyosaki described it differently, that in the private industry space, that if you were a manager, you were judged for how much you could do with as little as possible to make as much profit as you can. And the more money you made, the more important you were. And I don't mean you made personally, the more money you made for your company, the more important you were to them. And that didn't matter. If you had a staff of one and it was just you, but you made the company $5 million a year, well, hell, this guy's important. Don't mess that up. But if you were a government bureaucrat, the way you were considered important is the more people underneath you. The higher you were on a pyramid and the wider the base. Because since they didn't need to make a profit and the money was just stolen for them by the government, well, how else would you do it? Well, companies, not 100%, but to a degree, started to behave that way. I'm telling you, the average company with 500 people in it, if you walked in there and randomly, like you went to the CEO and said, I'm going to give you a chance here. You get to pick 20 people. They're not subject to this experiment. So if I pick one of them at random, they have a card, a red card. And when they hand me the red card, I go pick another one. And I walk to this company of 500 people. And I walk around and go, you, out, you, out. And I laugh 100 people with no knowledge of what they do. Just so it's spread out, all I got to do is walk through the office and pick five here, five there, so they're not all clustered together and I don't get rid of whole departments. In a month or two, that company would adjust and just be on the fly. They'd be like nothing ever happened. Look how many fucking people Elon Musk threw the hell out of Twitter and nothing bad happened. They cried, they bitched, they said it was going to be terrible. The news talked about it. Oh, the world is ending. Twitter will crash and burn into the sun and destroy us all. And nothing fucking happened. More than half the employees gone. Company still runs. How many times do you think that can be repeated? And when the thread gets pulled and the tapestry starts to come apart and your company is going to survive if you ditch 30% of your workforce and go under if you don't, you're going to figure out a little bit more accurately than Jack's random method. And now you get back into the 70s. You get back into the 70s where there's one job posting and 78 applicants, and they all say the same thing. I work hard, and I'm trustworthy, and I have good experience, and blah, 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 blah. And out of those 78 candidates, there's 10 that have a chance to get the job, and those 10 are so equally matched, I can literally put their faces on the wall and throw a freaking dildo with a suction cup over my back the way Vice picks out their story headlines, and whoever it sticks closest to, hire him, and I'll be fine. That's the world you're heading into. That's the world you're heading into. So you're going to have to either be extremely skilled or very flexible as a generalist, somebody that can really adapt to any opportunity and see the opportunity before others do so they can get to the front of the line before there even is one. Next, You're going to have a work ethic, and this is why I'm so much on my grandson, because he doesn't have one at all. I told him yesterday, you know, you love to play baseball. You're out practicing all the time. You think you're working hard, but you know you're not. You don't lift any weights. You don't do any cardio. You don't do any conditioning. The kids you're playing against, now that you're getting up, you know, he's in developmental leagues and stuff. He's 13 years old. You're starting to compete against people that take this shit seriously. And you don't have a work ethic for something you love. And you ain't going to love your first job, but you're going to need a work ethic for it. What kind of work ethic? I just thought to myself when I was putting my notes together today, who are the hardest working people you ever knew in your life? And in my family, it was the people that were coal miners. It was my father, my grandfather, a couple of my uncles. Even if it wasn't what they did their whole lives, you could tell that these men had a work ethic that if something needs doing, it's getting done. And if somebody has to die to make it done, then somebody has to die to make it done. It's a military mindset. It's a mission, not a task. The hardest working people, and I'm not saying they are the hardest working people. I'm saying the hardest working people I ever knew, which means no matter if somebody else works harder, they work really hard. Well, you're going to need a work ethic that makes a 1920s coal miner go, holy shit, wow, I can't keep up with this guy. That's the work ethic you're going to need, not just to survive, but to thrive through this period of time. So we have to be working hard to build that work ethic into our kids. And I'll tell you, I had a shitty childhood. I was on my own since I say 16. It was like 2 weeks before my 16th birthday. I moved out on my own. I've been on my own ever since. And this is why I try not to hold my grandkids, and when my son was growing up, not to hold him to my standard for where I was at their age, because it's a different scenario. It's a path I don't hope for anybody to ever have to walk. But they got to have the work ethic. You're also going to need an entrepreneur's mindset. I mean, you're going to need it. Right now, it's good to have. You're going to need it. And I don't care if you don't start a business. You're going to still need an entrepreneur's mindset. This is sort of a part of the work ethic, but it's also beyond the work ethic. It's a moral work ethic, is I guess what I mean. So what I mean by that is you're lucky you get a decent job. You have visibility into something where the company is, let's say, hemorrhaging money. They don't have to. You need to not go, hey, boss, I have some ideas about how maybe we could fix this. I'd like to put them together for you if I could, because he's going to tell you to go pound sand. An entrepreneur that sees a problem does not ask permission to solve the problem. They go to work and figure out the solution to the problem, and then they try to fix it. Well, in a company, you may not have the authority to fix it, but no one is going to stop you from going home after you punch out and developing a solution. And when you tell your boss about the problem, he says, yeah, he knows. You can go, hey, boss, I've been working on this for 6 weeks, doing some research, talking to some folks. Don't worry, I didn't give away any company information on, but I called some people within my network and my network's network and asked them about what's coming and how it's going. And I put together this 16-page report that tells us exactly how to get past this. And on page 5, it shows the KPIs and the exact amount of money we can save. Here. That's the person that's going to not just do well, they're going to excel. That's the person that's going to develop a reputation where they have a headhunter trying to pull them out of something good to something better. That's what it's going to take. Now, if you really want to do it right, then you take that mindset and you use it for yourself. But as much as I've done as an entrepreneur, I have to tell you that fighting my way through the business world, the corporate world as an employee, made me a much better entrepreneur. You know, everybody says, I wish I would have started when I was 18 instead of 35. I don't. As soul sucking is some of the things I had to do through that. And I'm not talking about the early years. I'm not talking about sweating your ass off packing a box. What sucked about that was getting paid dog shit for it. I'm not talking about installing fiber optics for Lockheed. You know, what sucked about that is I didn't get paid enough for it. That job, if they paid me well, there probably wouldn't be a podcast today. There probably wouldn't be. I'd probably be working for Lockheed because they would have eventually hired me out of contracting into a full-time job, And I'd probably live somewhere down near Grand Prairie, Texas right now. The only reason I was motivated to keep going somewhere else is it didn't pay enough to give me what I wanted in life. You got to have a hunger. That's another piece of it. But by going through there, by being part of a large corporate system at a high level, you know, a VP level eventually, and then working with Neil where it was like a hybrid, I had a job, but yet I was an owner in the company, I learned so much from the people around me that it was way better than college ever could have been because I had no preconceptions of bullshit from college professors that never did the thing that I was doing. I only had the people around me that were either making it or failing to learn from. So it was quite valuable. So I think even the person that wants to eventually be an entrepreneur would do well to understand that when you're 18, it might mean flipping burgers or scraping shit, metaphorically, because there's a lot of things that feel that way, even though they're a little bit better. You're going to have these young people, we're going to have to develop a fiercely independent mindset in them. They're going to have to be nonconformist to the core of their very being. And you might think, okay, I got that because my kid don't listen to shit I say. Hold on. The problem is they're going to have to be somewhat chameleon-like. And I have to say, this is another thing that helped me a lot, but I gained from it. I think they're going to need it. And what I mean by that is you have to know when to shut up and nod your head. You have to know when to go along to get along. Because that sets up the opportunity where you can break out. You can't always be telling the person you work for how stupid and wrong the company that you guys work for is. You can't. Especially when you're 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. Because you're a dumbass and you don't know anything. And you're worse, you don't know you're a dumbass and don't know anything. You know so little, you don't know that you don't know. So you have to have this kind of hybrid-like, chameleon-like capability to get, yeah, boss, okay, we'll take care of that. I'm not saying to use those words. I'm saying that's the mindset. Yeah. But you still have to be so independent thinking that, well, if this job ain't going nowhere, then the only reason I'm here is because of the paycheck and experience, and I've got the experience. I ain't going to learn anything else. I got to go look for something else, and I need to be building something while I'm looking for something else. Where most people don't have enough independent thought that, like, they tell you, well, in 6 months when we get reviewed, you get a raise. And they're like, oh, okay. 6 months comes, either you don't get the raise or you get a 3% raise while you had a six-month period of inflation that exceeded 3%. You actually got your pay cut and you think you got a raise because you can't think independently because the TV said inflation was only 1% and your boss said 3% was three times inflation. So you must be doing good and your 401k is now a 201k, but at least it's there and it'll all come back and don't worry about it. And you're the one that's going to get flushed when that company has to cut 30% of its workforce, by the way. The people like that. They get flushed. Because when you figure out who you don't need, you never need those people. They're useful, but they're not necessary. The independent thinker who still knows not how not to disrupt internal operations, they become intrinsically valuable to the point of, what do we do to make sure we don't lose this person? It's back to something I've said before. When you're interviewing for a job, you need to present yourself in such a way that you, the guy, now, if it's flipping burgers, some entry-level bullshit or whatever, this doesn't apply. If you can't get that job, you have a real problem. But as you move up into anything that's entry-level, middle management, or equivalent across the board, sales, marketing, whatever, you want that manager who's interviewing you to think the following thing. If you get this one thought in their head by the end of that interview, you're going to get an offer. Unless they got somebody they feel the same thing more about. I don't want this person working for my competitor. I don't want them to go down, if I'm Spacely Sprockets, I don't want them to go down to Cogswell Cogs, pulling a lot of old school pop culture day. I don't want them to go to Cogswell Cogs. I'm going to fucking hire this person just to make sure that doesn't happen. Well, when you're the person I just described, fiercely independent in thinking, yet know how to operate within the politics of the company you're in, you're that after you're hired. And now we've entered a state, and I think it's going to stick, where non-competes are complete bullshit and don't mean anything. Now that's just went up 10x. Because now I can literally go straight to Cogswell Cogs. I don't have to go work somewhere else for 2 years until my non-compete expires. Like, non-competes are dead in the water, if you don't know. That happened this year. It's a Supreme Court decision. How long did it take to change Roe v. Wade back? What was it, 50 years? Roughly 50 years? So for 50 years, based on history, this is not coming back. This is not coming back. So it's more the case that you're going to be extremely valued if you're that person. You're going to need to be ready to up and move rapidly. And I mean geographically or shift careers. And this is another thing that did me well. I came here from Pennsylvania with nothing. Literally a $400 car and the shit that would fit in it. And unemployment of $180 a week. That's what I came here with. And a DD-214 that said I was a good boy in the Army and I didn't do anything bad. That's it. That's all I had. But I was willing to move because I knew there was nothing where I was at. And then when MCI agreed to hire me as a contractor and train me in telecom, it was because I would get in my truck and drive to Houston 1 week and El Paso the next and New Orleans for a month. And that, like, that movement. And then the big boost in my career was when I went to work for Microtest, which Fluke bought out like a couple months later, and I ended up as a VP of sales for Fluke. That required a movement from Texas to Pennsylvania. And we were willing to do it. If I hadn't done that, that would have been a break in the chain of that continual advancement. Everything that I did to build success, starting with nothing, through the 90s and early 2000s, is going to be 10 times more important between now and 2040. It already is, and it will become more so in time. You're going to need to know, on the other side, how to do the things we teach. The person that can grow their own food is less subject to manipulation. If I have myself even a couple, 3 acres doing some stuff like Nick and I talked about yesterday, I'm producing 20% of my meat from, you know, rabbits and quail that I have no real money into their food. I have a garden and I'm producing, you know, half my produce. I'm not growing all my own food, but my cost of living is down. If I know how to fix shit and when something breaks in my house, I don't call a guy, I just fix it. How many times do I do that a year before it adds up to a couple $1,000s? It'll be more the case in the future because that guy will cost you more in the future because when somebody needs somebody in the future, that need is going to be more expensive. We call it inflation. We know it will be more expensive because it always has been, especially since 1913 Ford and damn sure since 71 Ford. So we're going to need it. I just got a question, all caps. That's how to do that. And I did see it only because it was all caps. If you want me to answer something for you, just the word question in all caps will work. I forgot to say that today. But you're going to need to know how to grow food, how to cook, how to fix things. All the hard life skills that kids aren't taught anymore. Now, I want to pause on that bullet point. And I want to tell you, this is why I'm afraid for Gen Z, Gen Alpha in the 30s. Because they're not learning any of it. And I know you might be like, Jack, I teach my kids all this stuff. Yes, and it will be a tremendous advantage to them because as a demographic, they're not learning jack shit. I guarantee you, you pull the average 15-year-old boy off the street and say, start that lawnmower, and you make it a little bit hard. There's no gas in it, but there's a gas can sitting right next to it. I'd say if half of them could do it, I would be surprised. 1980s, when I was a teenager, if you walked up to a 15-year-old kid and said, start a lawnmower, where's my money? I just mowed your lawn. I want $5. You get $5 to mow like a standard suburban lawn back then. And kids did it. They don't know how to do that. Tell a kid today, here's a new spark plug. There's one in that lawnmower over there. And go ahead and gap it for them. So they don't even have to gap it. Give them the freaking spark plug socket with the extension and the ratchet handle so they have everything that they need. Hand it to them and say, change the spark plug on that lawnmower. Good luck with that shit. They don't know what a spark plug is or does. And this is why I'm afraid for them. Yes, my grandson knows how to start a lawnmower. My grandson knows what a spark plug is. Hell, my granddaughter knows what a spark plug is. My granddaughter knows how to feed ducks and chickens. My granddaughter knows how to pick shit out of a garden, just like I did at that age. But as a demographic, they don't know shit. Which means if you take the time to teach your kids or grandkids the stuff I'm talking about today, they are going to be, you know, top 10% when it comes to people that are able to, you know, adjust and adapt to this society that we're heading into. It needs to be high tech and low tech together. Even the highly educated, high degree specialist, high demand, still needs to know these other things. They still need to know these other things because entire sectors will get destroyed in a matter of 2 or 3 years, which is like overnight in that world. I mean, completely obliterated. And some of them will not be replaced with an equivalency of opportunity. I want you to think about it this way. What were CDs worth in 1990? Quite a bit. But the reality was, 1990, CD players hadn't come down in cost enough that most people were still actually buying most of their music on cassette tapes. Right? Most people still didn't own a DVD player. You went to Blockbuster, what'd you rent? Be kind and rewind before you bring it back, right? I remember when I was, you know, in this stage we're talking about, 94, 95, when I was working for Lockheed, had my first apartment on my own down here. And I used to stop by and rent movies all the time. All I rented was tapes. I remember in my little town of Pennsylvania, there were entire little businesses that God figure out, negotiated a deal, rent a place not bigger than much bigger than my office, maybe 2-3 times the size of my office, get an inventory of video cassettes in there, dollar a movie, 2-day rental. Employ 2 or 3 kids out of the town that were making minimum wage and happy for it because they could walk to work, and dad stopped telling them, you need to get a job, you need to get a job, you need to get a job. They worked when the kids weren't available, and they bought houses. Boom. Gone. Obliterated. No DVDs, no VCRs, no CDs, no tapes, nothing. But the hipsters are bringing back LPs. Yeah, go make a living on LPs and tell me it's good. No, because now we can walk around with a device the size of this thing in my hand here with an entire catalog of tens of thousands of songs on it. And we don't even need that because the same device can just access it out of the cloud for $8, $9 a month. We can listen to anything we want. We can go to YouTube and listen to it for free, and people still pay for it. Now, some of this, the thing about this is there was so much innovation while those little industries collapsed that there was a place for people to go. But we're getting to a point where we're eliminating the need for humans in many places. Our labor participation rate's already shit, and jobs are already hard to find. Right now, there's about one job for every unemployed person, but there's no qualified people for those jobs, or they'd have been hired by now. Or they pay so little, no one's willing. I'd rather make nothing than work for you. Or they're so in the minds of people beneath them, they won't do them. We still have people bitching about minimum wage. You want me to write you off as a total fucking ass clown? Say the word minimum wage to me in 2024. When fucking Chick-fil-A down the road from me is hiring people and can't keep staff high enough, for $16 an hour, they're hiring teenagers off the street. And you want to whine that minimum wage is $7 whatever it is an hour? I don't even care what it is. I've looked it up. About 1% of people in this country make minimum wage. If you take the teenagers out, who are mostly part-time workers, it's 0.75%. So of people over 19 that have a job at all, full or part-time, only 0.75% of that group make minimum wage. And yet, we have unfilled jobs, and people crying the wage isn't high enough. as though raising minimum wage to $20 an hour or whatever won't just make everything worse, because it will. Because now that all this tech's available, every time you pressure my wage expense, I start looking for those 30, 40% of people that I don't really need a little harder. Everybody goes under the microscope a little bit more. And that guy that wants to talk to me, and I've told my personal assistant back in the day when I worked with Neil, I have one named Allison. She was really good at telling people to screw off nicely, so I didn't have to. Mr. Spearco does not wish to be disturbed. Well, every once in a while, I'll be like, we have a problem, and I want you to try to look for some people that can help us with this problem right here. But if some, one of those people calls that you normally tell to screw off, and they say they work in this space, let them through. I start letting the technology people that sell the way to replace your job through my phone line for my PA, and I start buying technology instead of hiring people. That's coming hard, hard, hardcore today. You're going to need to teach your kids something that's really important. You should do this anyway, but it's going to be more important. The difference between education and school. You can never rely on the schools to do this because it's suicide for schools to do this. And that way they can figure out what their educational path looks like. And even the kid that's going to start college in 2029, it's 100 years since the stock market crashed. I wonder if that'll work like the last pandemic. You think I'm go back and we'll look. The flu pandemic really exploded in 1920. I'm just saying. Sometimes history rhymes a bit. But even the kid that's going to go to college, you know, starting 2029, 2030, 2031, 32, they might still need to do that. Really gifted kid wants to be a doctor. That's the way that you do that. For some reason, they actually want to teach at one of the remaining colleges that are still necessary. You're going to have to go to college to teach at a college. You want to be a high-level engineer, you want to go to a good engineering school, right? You want to be a high-level person in finance? I don't know what to tell you. I mean, right now, you still got to go to college for it, really, if you want that path into that space. But I think that space is going to change dramatically. But there are going to be places where that's what you need to do. Well, that is an education that is consistent with your goals. So the conventional educational path works for those people. It's probably the case that about 20% of people that go to college right now have any business in college at all. The only thing that gets them into college right now is money and easy access to it. Because this is, I'm going to promise you something right here, that this is the truth, even though there's no way to prove it. If I was Jack University, I'm a college, and I'm a mid-sized college, I have a student body across all 4 years of, let's say, 20,000 students. So it's not a very big school, about 5,000 per class. And the way that kids came to me and said they wanted to be a student in my school was that they either had the money in their pocket or we had to finance them. In other words, they had to borrow from me. We had owner financing, right? Let me tell you something about Jack University in that scenario. It's going to be competitive to even get offered a place in the school. Okay? You're going to have to be we're going to take the top 5,000 kids every year that we get applications from. And if we get applications from 20,000, means 15,000 get thrown on the floor. We're not building new buildings to take those 15,000 more kids in and expand in our school. Not if we have to pay the bill up front and wait on them after they get out to pay us back. And even if we have room for 5,000 this year, if we only have 3,000 that ain't freaking dum-dums, we're only taking the 3,000. And we're not going to have degrees in gender studies. Right? You're not going to be able to get a degree in bitterness studies. You're going to have to get a concrete degree with a known income on the other side of it for us to take the risk and finance that. Now let's change the scenario to Jack University like it really is today. Jack University has the libraries and all the stuff that the federal government says that we have to have for you to qualify for a student loan. I don't give a fuck how well you do or do not do while you're in college, and I certainly do not give a fuck after you walk out the door. I do not care. I know they pretend to care. They do not care. And I'm going to grow to where I have a student body of, let's say, 50,000. And as long as 10,000 out of the 50,000 that go on become alumni to give me more money for my endowments while I don't finance your education so I can build more shit and I can just raise my tuition anytime I want, I really don't give a fuck how bad you fail. Don't care. I don't care. And the reason I don't care is if I bring 50,000 students through, I know that 10,000 are going to do well. And everybody says, well, I went to Jack University and I can't get a job. It'd be like, he's a loser. Look at all of our success stories. You see how that works? I don't care. It doesn't matter to me because it's not my money until I take it. And once I take it, you're not getting it back. There's no refunds. You graduate Penn State, can't get a job. You don't get your money back. You still have to pay it. And whether you pay it or not, Penn State has the money. You see how that works? That's why I'm telling you about 20% of people that go to college actually belong there. That they're going to have a path in life that their degree is truly going to be advantageous to their quality of work. There's plenty of people with degrees that help them advance, but that degree ain't got nothing to do with their quality of work. There's plenty of people that are in management roles, you know, senior project management roles and things like that. And they have a degree, and if they didn't have that BA or whatever, generic freaking degree with at least some core things that matter, they wouldn't have got the job, but they could have moved into that position and done just as well had they gained their education somewhere else. We have this captive funnel right now, a screening requirement. Karen in Human Resources says BA in, you know, in management or whatever required. She just cut and paste it over and over again, app to app. Because so many people have a degree, why not add it on, like a la carte? I'm going to get it for free, and it's something extra. Like, if you were going to go buy a car, and they said, well, do you want the upgraded sound system and the upgraded tech package and the upgraded, you know, window tinting and all that jazz, and it was a $35,000 car? You'd be like, well, what's it cost? No, it's free. Fuck yeah, throw it all in there. Right? If nothing else, I got higher resale value. That's how people look at degrees right now when they're hiring. It's like getting all the extra shit on the car for free. They know they don't need it, but hell, maybe I will someday. Maybe it'll be good. They're also going to need to be able to see to their own health primarily through diet. Folks, they're killing us. Whether it's intent or consequence, doesn't even matter. The what matters more than the why. As a society, they're killing us. When you have more dialysis clinics than Subway restaurants in a society that even barely knew what type 2 diabetes was 50 years ago, and today there's so many people with type 2 diabetes destroying their kidneys, that we got remote little dialysis clinics everywhere. We got billion-dollar companies. All they do is run small dialysis clinics. They're killing us. Well, the leading actual cause of death in this country, one way or another, tracks back to obesity and cancers that really didn't exist in quantity 50 years ago. They're killing us. When the cost of health insurance exceeds the cost of rent for an apartment, they're killing us. When they're selling drugs for $20,000 a year so that you can eat garbage and not be quite as fat, not skinny, just not quite as fat, that's literally paralyzing the digestive systems of people and fucking up things like their pancreas and intestines. We call those GLP-1s. They're killing us. They couldn't sell you a $20,000 monthly injection to be a little less fat, not to be skinny, again, to be a little less fat, if they weren't killing you to begin with. Go back and look up pictures of people on the beach from like 1970 to 1985. You'll find a fat person here and there. That's it. Not everybody's good looking. Right? You can be skinny and ugly, but there ain't a lot of fat people. Anybody listen to me right now that's my age or a little bit older, that you grew up 70s, 80s, you know what I'm talking about. If you grew up in the 60s, you really know what I'm talking about. You know, we used to, in gym class in high school, we used to climb ropes, right? Like, and if you could climb the knotted rope to the top, you were okay, but you really should be able to climb the non-knotted rope. We used to climb, I don't even know what you call them, peg walls. You have these pegs and there's holes in the wall. And like you pull this peg out, pull yourself up with your left arm, boom, boom. And you see how high you can climb on that peg wall. Most of the guys in my gym class in high school could get most of the way up that peg wall, if not all the way. Now the damn they have to put metal pegs in there so the friggin' fat kids don't break the pegs off in the wall. I'm not insulting anybody. I'm just telling you that's where we are. They're killing us. I shared an article today on social media. If you follow me there, maybe you saw it. So researchers have now found microplastics in the muscle of the penises of men. Microplastics in the penis. Gee, why is our fertility rate absolutely dog shit? I personally think we are being systematically killed and depopulated. But and when people say, Jack, it's just a con, then I don't care. It doesn't matter, does it? All that matters is the people that could do something about it are doing nothing about it except profiting from it. You need to teach your kids how to physically take care of themselves through diet and activity. And I don't even think the exercise activity is that important. And I'll tell you why. People that eat well are active. They have energy, so they find something to do with it. It might not be playing squash or racquetball, right, or going to the gym. But they go out and do something. They go out and do something. I got out of the Army. I was bored. I took a walk from Pennsylvania to freaking New Hampshire. You know what I mean? Like, because I was bored and didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. How many people today are doing that? Now, we have people that are in great shape today. Don't get me wrong. I'm talking about the average aggregate. So those are all the things I think you need. I've got some stuff real quick I'm going to go through, more lightning round-like, that I think that you don't need it, but it would be very beneficial. And all of this applies to today. It's just going to apply more in the future. One is, I think it'd be a really good idea for any of you guys with kids out there to have them learn at least one additional language for a lot of reasons. When I was in school, they told us you need to take a language and have 2 years of foreign language if you want to get into a good college, because it was actually competitive to get into a college. And a lot of us did it even if we didn't think we were going to college because, well, I might want it. So I have to have this to get in. And I didn't really understand it. And I had a pretty good Spanish teacher, and I talked to him one day and I said, but I don't dislike your class or nothing, but why do I need this to go to college? I'm not going to go to college to be a Spanish teacher. And he said, because when you learn another language, it expands your understanding of your own. And when you have an expanded understanding of your own language, you have an expanded understanding of all things, because language is how we describe things. And I went, well, that's a really good answer. I thought I was being a smartass, and I was going to get a stupid answer and be able to, like, smirk, because that's how I was as a teenager. I was a smirker. I got that answer and went, shit, wow, I just learned something. Wow, this guy's a good teacher. Maybe I should pay a little bit more attention. So that's the old-fashioned reason. But people that are saying, like, Russian or Mandarin in the live chat here, Builder of Castles is saying that, you're getting the point about the future. There's going to be a hell of a lot of opportunity. This international commerce and linguistic software will only take us so far. So I speak decent Spanish. I would call it fluent. I'd call it almost fluent, pseudo fluent, right? But decent Spanish, which, by the way, I learned a hell of a lot more Spanish in Honduras and Panama than I did in high school for 2 years. But I think the 2 years in high school studying Spanish accelerated my learning when I was surrounded by people that spoke Spanish, the immersion style learning. But I didn't learn French, and I know like 5 words in French and how to count. That's it. Oui, oui, blah, 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 blah. Right, there's French, right? Blah, 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 blah. Wine, cheese, blah, blah. Anyway, my point that I didn't speak French is when I had that job as VP of sales for Fluke, my territory included Eastern Canada. Now, in a lot of parts of Eastern Canada, I think those numbers are off, Builder. I don't think it's that low, but it better not be, or Rachel's going to start flonging people. Please hit the like button. But when I had Eastern Canada, there's a lot of places in Canada that they speak French. And Gank is saying French only, I bet. And yes, I mean, like, those people didn't speak English. And my, you know, I had sales reps, because you have a territory that big, you can't handle all the on-site stuff. You come in to negotiate, to train, to help penetrate accounts, things like that, to do distributor relationships. And when we would go see people who didn't speak English, she would translate. We completely understood each other, but there was something lacking in that discussion. There was my ability to influence that individual was severely impaired. I had to rely on whichever rep was with me and their ability to do that based on what I was telling them. And so I needed that person. So all the language translation software and all that for putting a spec from here to there, sure, that's even limited. I have a very good friend right now who's working with a South Korean company, and there's a lot of issues because of this. And you need people that are multilingual to have that human connection to get business truly done. And it's like for the future, you need to be building this giant Swiss Army knife. And that's a tool that you may not always need, but when you need it, you're not going to have anything else able to do it, nor will the person willing to pay you for it. So I think that's a really good, nice to have. You need to have a good idea, a good eye for opportunity. I think that's a great thing. It's always been a great thing, but it's going to be more so in the future to notice that this opportunity exists. Now, I mean, see the opportunity and do something with it. It might be seeing that this industry is going to grow, so you get yourself educated, whether it's conventional or alternative, for that industry as it's being built, so that when it really starts to take off and there's a labor shortage, the fact that you know jack shit anything, they'll hire you. Let me tell you something. 1996, if you could build websites with front page, you could get an entry-level web design job, because there were so few people that could build a website. Now, if you're like, well, I can use front page, nobody knows what it is anymore. I don't even know if they make it anymore. So I learned how to build websites. And there are industries like that, that when they begin to really grow, there's very few people that know anything about them. And so if you know anything and can do anything, you can get in the door, and then you have to be able to adapt and grow with the industry and outpace your competition from inside. But you can see that. So that's one type of way you can see an opportunity and capitalize on it. Another would be, hey, I noticed that there's a bunch of fucked up fences in this neighborhood, and it's a pretty wealthy neighborhood. And if I started knocking on doors and offered to fix and seal fences so they wouldn't get fucked up, even though there's companies out there, they can make a phone call and do it, since nobody's knocking on the door and asking, maybe I could make some money and start a business that way. Or, you know, maybe in 2008, you see that preparedness and homesteading and all is on the upswing. And then you look at the podcast space and there's nothing any good in it. So even though you start out with a little tiny recorder with noise in the background in a car doing a podcast, your podcast explodes because you see the opportunity. And yes, I'm talking about myself there, right? You can be skinny and ugly. Somebody's just catching up with the live stream right there. That was a while ago. So, yeah, like if you could find opportunity and prepare yourself to utilize the opportunity, because, man, I got this idea. I don't know how many people told me, you know that thing that does XYZ? I thought of that before anybody did anything with it. Yeah, so did 1,000 other people. And you know what you get for that? You don't even get a fucking donut, right? You don't get a donut and a coffee for that. You know the little stir they give you for your coffee? You don't even get one of those. Your idea is not, you seeing the opportunity means nothing unless you're able to capitalize on it. So the eye for opportunity and ability to capitalize. Cognitive flexibility. What is that? That means your mind is able to adapt to what surrounds you quickly. People made a lot of money during COVID. People had their lives destroyed during COVID. The difference was mostly cognitive flexibility. Well, I see what all these fools are doing now. I'm not doing it too. But since they're all doing this, I mean, there are people, I know people that made money selling bullshit that they knew was bullshit. Selling bullshit, like selling masks before, when they were in limited supply, they were selling masks, hand sanitizer, shit like that. Just because they saw the, now, I'm not saying to be that much of a, I call that flim flam man type thinking. But they did something with it. As much as I don't like kind of that parasitic mindset, I respect it more than a person that stayed home, made a toilet paper fort, hid inside it, and bought the damn mask. I respect it way more than that. You know, there are people on that freaking years ago, and I said, do nothing, don't worry about it. You know what I'm talking about? The earthquake in Japan that fucked up the nuclear reactors, and Mike Adams and Alex Jones were saying that we were going to have untold numbers of people dying from cancer within a couple of years. Never happened. They never backed up and retracted it. I said, do nothing. There were people that made a fucking fortune selling potassium iodine tablets. When that happened to people that had no idea why they were buying them whatsoever, or even what to do with them, they thought it was a cure-all for being irradiated instead of it just protects your thyroid. Didn't even know they were paying, you know, $20-$30 for $2 worth of potassium iodine tablets. There's always opportunity if you're willing to capitalize on it, but it requires a cognitive flexibility to see, adapt, and not be co-opted into mass hysteria or into fear or into anything else. The ability to interpret data in a way that actually reflects reality. That means having a good bullshit filter. If you want me to make a case right now that the Democrats are right and the economy is good, I can use data to prove that they're right. I will have to lie to you. I will have to knowingly and willfully lie to you to do it, but I damn sure can make a compelling case for it. I can show you all kinds of metrics and do some axis adjusting in my graphs and things like that, decide where they stop, where they end. I can play all kinds of games by selectively picking different credible sources for projections into the future. I can go back and take the economy that we all know was good under Trump. And he doesn't even get credit for it, by the way. Presidents have less to do with the economy than we think they do. That's part of understanding what I'm talking about here. But the economy in 2018 was better in every measurable way than it is in 2024. I'm sorry, and if you disagree with that, you're just wrong and blind. However, you want me to prove that it wasn't? I can do that. I used to be a VP of sales for a $500 million company. I had to go and explain my numbers once a quarter to a board of directors that were wearing suits that were worth more money than my car. I can make those fucking numbers sing freaking hallelujah, praise the Lord Jesus Christ if I want them to. I can make those numbers say anything I want if I get creative enough. So numbers and data are useless until you know how to interpret them accurately. And if you can do that, there's two things that happen. One, you find those opportunities and you use that cognitive flexibility to capitalize on those opportunities. But two, you stop believing the bullshit that they throw at you from the TV set. Yeah, the economy was really good in 2018, but that's because we pumped so much money and liquidity into the markets leading up to it. And Trump was in the right place at the right time to go, ooh, I did it. And yeah, the economy sucks right now under Biden, but that actually has a lot to do with the trillions of dollars pumped into the economy under Trump for the stimulus and the stimulus checks and all that other bullshit. And then Brandon took over, and to be, you know, fair to Trump, he's even dumber and he's messed things up way worse because presidents can't do a lot to make the economy better, but they can do a lot to make it worse, right? It's almost like if we didn't have a president, we'd be better off. Economically anyway, right? But yeah, you need to be able to interpret data in a way that actually reflects the underlying reality. And the only way I know to do that is to take data and manipulate it to the positive and the negative and actually do it. You have to do it to see it. Because I can tell you this, and intellectually you can go, you know what, Jack doesn't ever bullshit me. Sometimes I disagree. And sometimes he even comes on and says, I got this thing wrong. But overall, he's honest and he's usually right. And I completely believe, Jack, that data can be manipulated that way. But if you've never done it, or at least somebody deconstruct it for you and show you how they did it, you don't really believe it. You believe it the way we believe in, like, mystical things. You believe it, but you don't know it. Right? You have faith, not knowledge. You are agnostic in spite of the fact that you have faith in what I'm telling you. But once you deconstruct it yourself, and once you reconstruct it so it gives a positive image on this side and a negative image on this side, you go, oh, it's not just doable. It's actually pretty easy. It's actually pretty easy. And then all of a sudden, you cure your Gelman amnesia. When the guy comes on TV and shows you this graph, you immediately go, fuck your graph. It might even be accurate, but I'm going to assume it's bullshit. And if I actually care about this thing you're talking about, I'm going to go find not the way I feel, not what some other talking head says, not what some other graph says. Where's that data coming from and what does it actually tell me? This makes you able to navigate things and be more cognitively flexible, but it also makes you very valuable. It also makes you very valuable to a company when you're able to interpret data in a way that they can capitalize on. And you need, and I believe everybody needs this one. I really put it in beneficial. The hunger to be a lifelong learner. Almost every person in this audience has that, or you wouldn't listen to a show like this. I'm not a comedian, even though I might make you laugh from time to time. The main thing I do here is I teach. And the fact that you listen to it means you want to learn or you wouldn't. And you probably listen to other things that teach. And you probably watch videos that teach. And you're probably way more interested in a video that teaches you how to make beef jerky or grow your garden or write code or use a technology than some chick shaking her ass on TikTok. That's probably who you are. You need to teach your kids to be that too. That if they're not learning something every day, they're failing themselves. And I think that's a really important way to put it, guys. Gals. All right. Folks. So that way I don't have to always do that. If you tell your kid, son, if you don't learn something every day, you're failing dad. You're failing mom. You're failing your school, your teacher, your coach, whatever. They might even Johnny Bob's his head. Okay, dad. It doesn't go in. If you can get him to understand, Johnny, you're failing Johnny if you don't learn something every day. And I don't get to tell you what you're going to learn. You learn what you want. In addition to the things you have to learn, you need to learn something that you would not have learned had you not taken an action every day, or you're failing yourself. You wasted that day. You only get so many days to live, son, grandson, daughter, granddaughter, whatever. You only get so many days. And you'll run out. At one point, if you're lucky, you'll be old and you can still learn, but you're not going to really be able to apply it anymore. We all reach a point, unless we die young, middle age, something like that, where we really can't capitalize on things anymore. We retire, you know? Doesn't mean our life has no meaning or purpose, but you can't learn something and be like, holy shit, I'm going to build an empire with this. There's a point where we pass that, and either we can't or we just don't really want to anymore. So if you don't, while you're 10, 12, 13, 14, 18, 20, 25, 30, capitalize every day on that. I have an opportunity today to learn something I didn't know, or to change my perspective on a thing, to challenge what I've been taught. And I don't do it. I pissed away that day. I wasted that day. You can be on vacation, fishing in a pristine river in the middle of Montana, never fire up an electronic device of any kind, and you can still get through that day learning something. If you have the right mindset, because the mindset is more about the eyes, the ears, and the heart being open and taking in all the information around you and going, I never noticed that before. And maybe it's later. I never noticed a bird that looked like that before. And you don't even get a picture off because your phone was in the bag where it belonged, so you can enjoy fishing for the trout. But in your head, you remember what that bird looks like. And when you do, get back to camp or the cabin or back to the world, you look up what a bird with these colors and that shape lives in this place is. You learn what it is. You'll never see that bird not know what it is ever again. That day wasn't wasted. You saw it and went, oh, look, a cool bird, blah. You didn't learn anything that day. Hopefully you caught some fish, so it wasn't completely wasted. But you wasted that piece of the opportunity. And again, all these things apply now, but they're not going to just be advantageous in the next decade. They're going to be critical. And the reason, again, I'm scared for that whole group, that whole basketball, that whole demographic coming through the pipeline that's going to be hitting what should be their stride 10, 15 years from now, is that we have not prepared them as a society to do it. The average 25, 30-year-old today is not prepared for this either, but they have their start. They have their start. They might get hurt when things start to thin out, but at least they have their start. We have people that can't change a spark plug or start a lawnmower and won't be able to 10 years from now that are not in any way emotionally resilient, physically resilient, mentally resilient. They're weak. They're incredibly weak, and I'm not putting them down. We did this to them. I cannot be more clear about this. When I say that they're emotionally weak, I'm not blaming the emotionally weak person. I'm blaming their fucking parents. I'm blaming their teachers. I'm blaming the fucking government. I'm blaming society. I'm blaming the goddamn adults that they grew up under for not doing their fucking job, which is making sure that they're prepared. But to be fair, a lot of parents today, way younger than me, my generation fucking failed them. So what do they have as a frame of reference for this generation? Nothing. But it's up to us to say, you know what? I'm going to do something about it. Because here's the beauty of the common denominator dropping. You teach your kids, you teach your grandkids this shit today, they are the top 10% of talent, right, and stability and opportunity seeking in 10 years. It's a guarantee. Because who else is going to do it? Does anybody out there, I got well over 100 people in the live right now, anybody out there think they're going to fix the school system to remedy this shit in the next 10 years? Tell me if it's you. No? Nobody thinks they're going to fix it. Okay, so the problem will get worse because it has to. We will not fix this until the crisis is so obvious that we are in the midst of catastrophe. That's when the building falls down, then the rebuilding will begin. Flamethrower makes sense. That's about what it takes now, right? A flamethrower, when we burn everything to the ground, then we'll start putting things back together. The problem, builder says, is dynamite available or usable, maybe. The problem is when everything falls apart, the number of people who know how to put it back together is going to be pretty small. That's going to put them in charge. That's my hope in this. And I do believe, if you look at every place that society's crumbled and empires have fallen apart, pretty good shit's come after it. Pretty good shit. Even the Dark Ages had some really amazing things go on once people got through the shit. So I think things will be much better in the future. But it'll be a while. I do have some, all from one person here. Let me see. Plant Propagation said, Texas, thoughts on Texas seceding, pivot to new currency, no debt obligations. We're not going to secede. I think there's a possibility, but it's in like the 10 percentile range, and I'm going to bet on the 90 in that arrangement. I don't know how much it would matter right now if Texas did it. It's not like we're not a police state. It's not like we don't have our own problems. I think maybe we would forestall the inevitable for a time. And then again, maybe we wouldn't, because I'm not so sure that the rest of the country would go along with it peacefully. He also said, you make me learn too much. My wife hates all my gardening projects. Yeah, well, she might like them when they're paying the bills someday, because they might. He also asked about plant propagation. Yeah, I mean, propagating plants is a lot like printing money. And anybody can do it, but most people won't. They think it's like special science. Though there are some things that you can learn about plant propagation that lets you propagate things that are hard to propagate, and that's where the real money is. It's not where I would start for most people. You need to establish a base. But once that base is established, you look into some things. You can produce things that are very expensive and hard to produce, but you learn how to produce them in large numbers. You can make a lot of money. And I want to propagate expensive plants that are about as big as this little shot glass when you ship them around, because it costs less money to get them where they need to go. And you can sell more of them at one time to one customer that way, because a little box can hold a bunch of them. Anyway, guys, I hope you enjoyed today's show. I hope it made you think. I hope it made you a little bit afraid, but also empowered for the future. And I hope if you have children in your life one way or another, that you're going to do what you can to help them adapt to this. I also want to tell you, if you like the show and the work that I do, one of the things you can do to help us out is do your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's tspaz.com. I have different items featured most days. Sometimes they're on the same item a day or two in a row. I do have an item today that I've featured before but haven't brought around in a while for you. It's an end grain wood bamboo cutting board. I'm a big cook. You guys know that. I have one of these. I just looked up today when I saw this was on sale for the second time ever. That has actually gone on sale, because I price track everything at T-Spaz. I bought mine in 2018. It's still flawless. It's got, you know, marks and stains in it, and it looks used, but it's got no cracks, no warping, no problems, simply because I wash it every time I use it, and about once a month I add mineral oil to it to keep it in good shape. It's heavy duty. It's an end grain cutting board. The reason you want an end grain cutting board is that when you're using a knife and you're cutting on a board, if you're cutting a cross grain, you are, by the very nature of it, dulling your knife. When you cut into end grain, it's like if you're looking at the tips of your fingers, like you do, like you're praying and look down, it's like the bristles on a dartboard. So as you're cutting, the knife finds its path into those openings, and your knife stays sharp longer, and it just performs better. And when you're chopping, cutting, etc., you get better results. And it's on sale for $45. This thing's worth $100, normally sells for $65. It's why I recommend it all the time. But $45, it's a deal. And in this day and age, you need to be looking for and capitalizing on deals. So if you want to up your cooking game, you know, and I'll admit this, I have a problem. I've said it before, but I do. I have a problem, and my wife just told me the other day, no more. She found a whole bunch more of them. I love cutting boards. I think they're beautiful. I like them. They're like artwork. They're my collectible. I've got a drawer, little skinny drawer on the side of my oven that pulls out like this, and I figured out like six of my cutting boards could stand up and sit in there, and she found them. So, and I didn't hide that I bought them. It's just that as my quantity has expanded, I've moved some of them, and she forgot about it. She said, no more boards. So with all these cutting boards, unless like I'm laying out a charcuterie board or something like that where I want something that's really pretty looking, when it comes day-to-day to what I actually use, I use this one. I have one cutting board. It's like a $500 board, end grain board. I still use this one. Why? Because it just works great. So consider picking one up today. And remember, you can always help us out by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. No matter what you buy, you'll help us out. Remember, Vivor has a ton of stuff to fit this audience. You can get the Vivor from my site at tspaz.com as well, and there you'll find a discount code for 5% off anything from Vivor. And kind of remember that, because they're really good at marketing. So if you bought from them through me before and they send you an email, remember to go back to my page before you buy it and get your extra 5 points off. Anyway, with that, I will catch you guys tomorrow with an expert counsel Q&A for the week. We'll wrap it up with a Friday flashback, and then next week we'll do it all again. Are they going to bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month.